Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Happy Tuesday to all of you. Nice to be with you. Appreciate you joining us on a Tuesday here on Sports Radio 610. Payne and Pendergast with you. We are with you till 10 o'clock this morning. Appreciate you getting up with us. We have a lot to get into today, Seth Payne. Oh. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Other than, let's see, Rockets players being assaulted. The Deshaun Watson case got a whole lot murkier yesterday.
Yeah.
The Astros. The Astros are getting back at least four of their five COVID dudes. Jose Altuve not amongst them.
Yeah. And the Astros didn't lose last night. I mean, they didn't
That's right. They didn't lose last night.
That's a positive.
That's a win, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
You know what they did? Objective number one, stop the bleeding.
They did.
They do now. Now, this is the key.
Yeah.
They've had quite a few breaks here in the early parts of the season. I mean, you know, maybe Major League Baseball, could have said, oh, wow, you guys have a lot of breaks here in the schedule.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and give you some Oh, yeah, we did that for a reason, didn't we? Because of potential COVID suspended games postponements and what have you. But no, Major League Baseball, I guess, is trying to my best guess is that they're trying to punish the Astros for the cheating scandal by just making any COVID issues just pretending like they're not there at all.
Yeah.
Other teams are getting postponed, but the Astros just played on through them. But they get Yuli back.
Yeah.
They get Bregman back.
Yeah.
They get Maldonado back.
Yeah.
Altuve will have to wait.
Indeed. All right, so the big story yesterday was after a quiet weekend on the Deshaun Watson front, Deshaun Watson's camp filed a reply. And it's a court document. It's a filing. It's 7 pages long. And Rusty Harden also issued a statement following the filing. Tony Busby has issued a salvo back. We're going to dig into all of that here early. We're going to talk about it throughout the show. Amy Dash is going to join us at about the halfway point of the show at 8 o'clock this morning, our legal expert, to help us with what this all means. Here's Rusty Harden's statement, Seth, and then we'll go through kind of the scorecard of things. Rusty Harden said yesterday, "Today we answered the lawsuits filed against our client Deshaun Watson. Mr. Watson has been adamant that he did not engage in any improper conduct, and we strongly believe him. Therefore, the answer to the question of whether we are saying that all 22 plaintiffs are lying about the allegations of sexual misconduct by Mr. Watson is a resounding yes." So they say it right there. They put it all out there. The 22 plaintiffs are lying about Deshaun Watson. Here is the summary of Rusty Harden's contentions about Deshaun Watson and these allegations. After the massage therapy sessions with Mr. Watson, 8 plaintiffs bragged about, praised, and were excited about massaging Mr. Watson. 7 plaintiffs willingly worked or offered to work with Mr. Watson after their alleged incidents. 3 plaintiffs lied about the number of sessions they actually had with Mr. Watson. 3 plaintiffs lied about their alleged trauma and resulting harm. 6 plaintiffs told others they wanted to get money out. No, I'm sorry, 5. 5 plaintiffs told others they wanted to get money out of Mr. Watson. And finally, 5 plaintiffs have scrubbed or entirely deleted their social media accounts.
So those numbers, obviously, it sounds like a whole lot, and it's hard to keep track because some of those allegations could be the same, to women did multiple different things.
Right.
He named 16 names in the document.
Okay.
14 of which were either, claiming all of those things you just said, two of which the only names that it's just way too many numbers here, Sean. Sorry. Okay, so 14 names included in here, and those were women who allegedly bragged about or offered to work with him again, lied, all those things. Two of the women of those 16 were only mentioned as having scrubbed or deleted their social media accounts.
Okay.
So I kind of, I don't know about the scrubbing of the social media accounts. I guess there's multiple different reasons for that. It feels like for stuff that where you could say, wow, you got caught lying if this is true, then there's 14 women there.
Yeah.
So that still leaves 10, well, what, 8 women?
Yeah.
Is it 22 actual
22
lawsuits
total.
Right now?
22 total.
So that leaves 8 women that aren't mentioned as far as having been allegedly caught in a lie.
Right.
But this is still 2/3 of the entire group of plaintiffs that Harden is claiming they've got really, really good evidence that they were dishonest in these lawsuit filings.
What's of all those things we just said, Seth, where, you know, there's 8 that bragged about massaging him, there's 7 that were willing to work with him again, some lied about the number of sessions and so on and so forth. What's the most damning thing, do you think? Like, of all those, like, what's the one where if I'm Tony Busby, I go, okay, that's going to be the hardest one for me to poke holes in? Because I feel like some of these Busby might have a field day with. I do feel like there's one, and I don't want to get your opinion on it, because to me there's one bullet point that I think is going to be the most difficult to overcome, and that's the ones that were willing to work with him again after the alleged incidents.
Well, okay, so to... So you're asking me which one of these is the most?
Yeah, yeah. Which okay. of all these, which one is the ones that Tony Busby would be the most concerned with?
Right. I think anytime there was any factual issues mm-hmm. with what they said, like he claimed that, because what you're talking about. So we're talking about two different things, Sean. You asked me, but then you told me what you were going to say. So let me respond to what you were going to say.
Okay.
You said that the women that were willing to work with him afterwards. I think if they lied about whether or not they worked with him afterwards, that's more damning. Mm-hmm. Because it's conceivable that, and I can recall in at least one or two of the lawsuits, a woman said that, you know, she told Deshaun what behavior was and was not acceptable, and that she tried to set a limit, and then when they had another session,
yeah.
he continued the activity.
Yeah.
But if in the lawsuit they claimed that they couldn't work with him again or they didn't work with him again, but then they did, well, then they were flat out lying if
yeah.
that's the case.
Yeah.
So likewise, I think some of the women have apparently family members, according to Harden, that were told that the women had a pleasurable experience with Deshaun Watson. They actually enjoyed it, all of that. That feels like, even though those witnesses will be recounting conversations, those are actual family members.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are the ones that are obviously going to be the biggest issues, just whether or not they were lying and there's factual evidence whether they're lying or not.
I think the thing that stands out to me is we put the number soup aside of all this. You know, I think we see the strategy that Rusty Harden's executing here, independent of the quantity of everybody. The thing that stands out to me, Rusty Harden's team has clearly gone to work big time since finding out the names of these women. They found out the names of these women, you know, publicly in lawsuits like a week ago. And now they've talked to, I'm assuming they've talked to family and friends of some of these plaintiffs. They got input from security guards. They've got reports that some of the plaintiffs talked to a close relative. I mean, they have, it would appear, clearly vetted a lot of people that are close to or associated with these plaintiffs in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
They've done a lot of legwork.
It's interesting on the football side of things how other teams might be looking at this.
Yeah.
So if there's 14 women that Harden seems to believe that they've got factual evidence or things that really contradict what those women put in the lawsuit, is that going to scare any of those women into pulling their lawsuit?
Right.
You know, if you feel like if they've been legitimately caught in a lie, I know what, look, I'm trying to put myself, if I had been legitimately caught in a lie in a lawsuit, I'm going to pull the lawsuit the hell away as fast mm-hmm. as possible. So if a bunch of women pulled their lawsuits after this, does that all of a sudden make a bunch of teams potentially more open to trading for Watson before the draft?
Yeah. We'll talk about that certainly as we roll on here in the first hour. But we'll dig plenty into what went on yesterday with the Deshaun Watson situation, including Tony Busby's reply to all this. We got Rusty Harden's reply filed in court in a statement from Rusty Harden where he says unequivocally, I mean, it's right there. He says the answer to the question of whether we are saying that all 22 plaintiffs are lying about the allegations of sexual misconduct by Mr. Watson is a resounding yes. So Harden and Watson's camp say that all 22 plaintiffs are lying in their lawsuits. What does Tony Busby have to say about that? Well, we will let you hear his statement next. All right, so getting you up to speed on everything going on with the Deshaun Watson case, we laid out the statistics, the numbers, when it comes to the reply that Rusty Harden filed yesterday. And again, I think to me, the overriding sentence in all of this, the 7 pages of the reply by Rusty Harden to all these allegations aside, Rusty Harden's statement in which he says, the answer to the question of whether we are saying that all 22 plaintiffs are lying about the allegations of sexual misconduct by Mr. Watson is a resounding yes. Here is Tony Busby's reply to Rusty Harden that he put out yesterday in a statement shortly after these filings became public. Busby says, as fully anticipated and despite his lawyer's previous statements, Deshaun Watson's only defense is to call these brave women liars. The weak and vague allegations made in defendant's response are demonstrably false. Watson can't deny he sought out an unusually high number of women for massages on Instagram. He doesn't deny he insisted on being nude or nearly nude. He can't deny the massage sessions occurred. He can't deny he wanted more than a massage, and he hasn't credibly denied that something bad happened during the session. He instead claims that any sexual acts were consensual. Of course, his definition of consent does not comport with that of everyone else. I have faith that the court process will sort out the truth as these matters progress. So, Seth, the bottom line here is both lawyers, at least in terms of what they're saying right now, still appear to be willing to and anxious to go fight each other in court over this.
Right. Which, and we've had a bunch of attorneys tell us, like, yeah, well, that's part of the, you know, that's part of getting a good settlement.
Right.
It's looking like you really want to go to court.
Right.
I think that at the very least, we in the general public have seen that now, okay, Harden, for at least 14 of the women, has an argument. You know, we'll see what the actual evidence is on both sides and what the text messages are and all of those things. But Harden at least has what seem to be pretty credible responses to at least 14 of the women. That leaves 8 of the women, you know, that he didn't name in the lawsuit, that perhaps he doesn't have as much evidence. They did just get the names of the women for certain just a few days ago. So Harden's camp has done a whole lot of work in a short order. I think that the interesting thing about Busby's response here is that Busby doesn't necessarily really address any of the things that Harden actually said in his statement. Mm-hmm. So Busby claims that they're demonstrably false, but doesn't offer any evidence as to why they're demonstrably false. He brings up other stuff, which is, yeah, it was an unusually high number of women for massages on Instagram, which, as you've pointed out, Sean, that's not a crime
in and
of itself.
Yeah.
It's suspicious, right?
Yeah.
Or it might raise your eyebrows, but it's not necessarily, or it's definitely not illegal. But the part about him actually, you know, seeking out sexual pleasure for massage, even if it's consensual, that's a whole other matter in terms of legality.
Yes.
I guess my biggest question is, and this is where Busby brings this up for a reason, it's, regardless of whether it's consensual or not, it's improper and unprofessional conduct within a massage setting. And the question that gets raised, you know, is we talk about, okay, maybe Harden has evidence that for 12 of these it was consensual. Okay, so, or for 14 of them it was consensual. Mm-hmm. Okay, so for the other 8, let's say hypothetically 14 of them were consensual. Okay, how does he broach the topic with the other 8? You know, like, exactly how does it lead in a massage setting, in a professional massage setting, how does it lead from a professional setting to an unprofessional setting?
Mm-hmm.
And it appears to be through a lot of the stuff that Deshaun, you know, Harden hasn't claimed that Deshaun didn't, you know, bring a tiny washcloth to the sessions and all of that. Like, all that's pretty unprofessional on Deshaun's part. And it's conceivable that maybe with 14 women it was consensual, but he also was pushing the envelope. And that 8 other women, depending on their perspectives and their backgrounds and everything else, might have found that incredibly threatening. Mm-hmm. Well, other women didn't. I mean, that's the game you're playing when you start pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable.
Yeah, it's a good point, Seth. That would be my biggest question for Rusty Harden is, you name 14 in here specifically that fit under those categories of maybe not telling the truth or having another session with Deshaun after alleged incidents occurred, things like that. There's 14 of them. What's the deal with the other 8? Have you just not gotten to them yet? Have you just not got? Yeah. Were you not able to talk to security guards or relatives or friends of them that gave you enough evidence? I mean, clearly Deshaun is going with the strategy of everybody was lying, but with these other 8, it is still a true he said, she said kind of thing.
Yeah. The other thing, too, I wish Harden's camp would stop saying is that there are only 2 instances where he forced sexual contact, or only allegations of 2 instances, because it's still a lot, right? To those now, in one of those instances where there was alleged forced contact, that's the one where Harden's claiming that the plaintiff actually tried to extort money out of Deshaun.
Yes.
Later on.
Plaintiff
so,
3,
I mean, that's if they have evidence of that, that's not really clear right now either, right, Sean? So plaintiff number 3, her name is mentioned in here. I'm trying not to mention the names as much as possible, other than a couple that are pretty well known.
Yeah.
One, because of the sheer volume of it, 2, out of just, you know, discretion for women that are complaining of sexual assault.
Sure.
There's still a whole lot of gray area here, and because of the volume of the cases, Harden can present all these names and, hey, look at all this evidence we have against them, but you can't forget that, there's still quite a few women also that you haven't mentioned yet.
That's right. All right, and there's still a lot to dig into, and the football part we need to dig into as well, because we're 9 days away from the draft. Could this be enough to move some teams to possibly make a trade for Deshaun Watson? We'll get to that at the top of the hour, but back to a little bit of football. What does history tell us the Texans can do with the draft capital that they've got for now? Their best pick is the 67th pick in the draft. What does history tell us they can find with that pick? We'll dig into that next. All right, as of right now, the Texans' first pick is the 67th pick in the draft. They're picking in the 3rd round. We'll see. Maybe some of this Deshaun Watson legal news shakes loose and a miracle happens and a trade happens before next Thursday. That would certainly change things for the Texans in many, many ways. However, right now, Seth, we've got to work with what we've got. The 67th overall pick in the draft. Aaron Reese did a good piece here, a very easily consumable piece on The Athletic. And I look at things through a similar prism where, okay, what can the Texans get with the 67th overall pick in the draft? And he does a really good job here. He looked at the 60 through 74th picks in the draft from 2010 through 2017. So back to the beginning of the rookie wage scale era through a period of time where we've got a reasonable body of work to assess these players.
Was it 2000 through 2017?
I thought it said 2010 through 2017.
He mentions Brad Meester in here, and I know Brad Meester was drafted way before.
Maybe it was 2000. Maybe I'm off on that. You're right. Yeah, so 2003. Yeah. Yes, you're correct.
I wouldn't have corrected you on it, except that I was going to make a point about Brad Meester in here.
Yes, he's mentioned. Is he a former teammate of yours, or is he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll get to him. He's an offensive lineman. So for the 17-year period of 2000 through 2017, it looks like, Seth, the easiest thing to find according to the numbers here, and I think the point of this segment is, okay, how well does this match up with what the Texans need? Knowing full well that the Texans need pretty much everything. Finding a good wide receiver seems to be the easiest thing to do in this spot in the draft that the Texans are in. And among the names that came off the board in this range of 60 through 74. So 67 is right smack dab in the middle. Recent names: Allen Robinson, Tyler Lockett, Cooper Kupp, Jarvis Landry, Juju Smith-Schuster, all came off the board in the range in the draft where the Texans are picking in right now. Man, I mean, you get anything equivalent to any of those guys, I don't care which one it is, that's a grand slam right there.
There are so many good wide receivers in the last few years in the draft. People are wondering, okay, is it because Is it because of spread offenses and 7-on-7 and all that that football, college football, is just actually producing that many more great wide receivers? Or is it just kind of luck in the draw? We go through this with certain positions at times from year to year where, hey, just you get a bunch of really good wide receivers and it looks like, oh, wow, the league's just rife with wide receivers. It doesn't necessarily always hold up, but this year it looks like it's still holding with the trend. There are a lot of really good wide receiver prospects in this draft. I guess the big question is, okay, can the Texans identify him? Because the Texans have taken Devere Posey and what Jalen Strong?
Jalen Strong was taking the pick after Tyler Lockett.
They caught a total of, what, 50 receptions between the two of them?
Thereabouts,
so?
Yeah,
right about 50 receptions between those two. So I would say both those guys I felt really good about at one point when they were younger.
Mm-hmm.
I felt awesome. I was really high on Devere Posey. I was really high on Jalen Strong. And, you know, neither of them worked out. Remember Jalen Strong tried to talk smack about the Texans last year during the season? And it was kind of like, okay, yeah, but dude, you've been with like 4 or 5 different teams already.
That's not right. Just
the Texans that mistreated you, apparently.
My favorite Jalen Strong story is back in – that was 2015 when he was drafted, I believe, 2015. That was back in the when I was on Afternoons with Rich and with Ted, and Matt Hammond was our producer. And during draft season that year, Matt Hammond made it a point to try to book as many – prospects on the show as he possibly could for the draft that the Texans might be looking at. And one of the prospects that he booked to come on for an interview with us was Jalen Strong. So he had Jalen Strong come on the show and we're interviewing him, and you can hear that Jalen Strong is somewhere where there's a lot of commotion going on. And I'm going somewhere with this story because people remember Jalen Strong, a very kind of thin build, lanky wide receiver, was overweight when he arrived at training camp. Somehow
That's a guy, right. Who's
like 6'3", 190 is overweight. So I say all that because when we interviewed Jalen Strong, he was clearly like out in public somewhere where there was a lot of commotion going on. And Matt Hammond gets in my ear during the interview in, like, you know, on the back channel, and he says, "Hey, I think he's at Cheesecake Factory." I said, I'm talking to him through the back channel while the interview is still going on, and Rich and Ted are talking to Jalen Strong. I'm like, "Why do you say that?" And Matt goes, "I think I just heard someone order a steak Diane in the background," which I guess that's like a signature dish of Cheesecake Factory. I don't know. I've only eaten at Cheesecake Factory like twice in my whole life. The menu's just too big for me. So he says, "Hey, ask him if he's at Cheesecake Factory." So we did on the air. We said, "Are you at Cheesecake Factory?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I love Cheesecake Factory. I love cheesecake, blah, blah, blah." Yada, yada, yada. He gets drafted by the Texans, and he shows up overweight. That's my Jalen Strong story.
For whatever it's worth, Steak Diane is like it's not owned by Cheesecake Factory or anything. It's just I guess they make it, but other restaurants do, too. So,
they do? Yeah. Okay.
It was good guess, though.
That was pretty solid. So anyways, Devere Posey, Jalen Strong, they are the counterpoint to finding wide receivers in that slot there.
Except that, it does seem like there's a good opportunity this year. I don't know. Offensive linemen are the best bet statistically at finding a starter in this range.
Just a solid guy.
Yeah, and I guess that makes sense because especially more and more offensive linemen that come out of college are ill-suited to make the transition to the NFL. They just a lot of them have never been in a three-point stance in their entire lives. It's crazy. But a lot of them don't start getting into a three-point stance until they start training for the NFL for the like combine training and everything. So it makes sense that there are guys that are a little bit more raw and that maybe they're undiscovered. They get a little bit of physical maturity on them. And then if they improve their technique, they end up being good in the NFL. That would be nice because I think that both in terms of a long-term solution at center and a long-term solution at left guard, well, and really a long-term solution at right guard, because if Marcus Cannon plays right guard, he's still in his approaching his mid-30s.
Yes.
So those interior offensive linemen, if they took an interior offensive lineman with that first pick in the third round, I'd feel like that was a pretty good bet. That guy might stick around for a while.
Do they need to treat it, Seth, because it's their – because this is that's their highest draft equity right now. Do the Texans need to treat it like you would treat a first-round pick? Like, you would never use a first-round pick on a guard or a center. But so do they need to, because it's their first pick, do they need to find somebody maybe at a more impactful position than interior lineman?
It's rare to use it on a guard or a center, but yeah. You're less likely to use a first round pick on a guard or a center. But no, I don't think so. I think you just gotta go by
player.
Your board.
Yeah.
You're at a position right now, and this is where it gets confusing. When people say best player available, there's always all kinds of unnecessary debate about whether teams are telling the truth about that or not. What happens is teams generally do go with the best player available, but their rankings of players are already skewed by what positions they need.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a big board, and there might be a tight end and an offensive guard that they rank pretty much equally, except that they know that they need a guard more. So the guard is higher in their rankings of players. They think that this guy's worth a fourth round pick because of his position. They might say, like, okay, these two guys grade out equally, but this is an offensive tackle, so he's worth going in the first round. This guy's a guard, so he was only worth taking in the second round. So I think they stick pretty close to that board and just take the best player available.
So they do mention your guy Brad Meester here. They say the numbers,
yeah.
The numbers of they added up the total number of seasons that guys in this range played. First of all, 25 of the 41 offensive linemen drafted in that range started at least 4 seasons. They say that number's inflated by Brad Meester spending 14 seasons as the Jags center. So he was a teammate of yours.
I think
14 seasons. That's a great draft pick right there.
Somebody asked why, because I was talking about how some guys have never been in a three-point stance.
Yeah.
Says, why put O-linemen in a three-point stance at all? Why not keep them in that stance that they're comfortable with? Because you just don't have any power out of a two-point stance.
Yeah.
You'll get – the problem is in college you're playing against boys, and then in the NFL
these are men.
You're going against men who will pick you up and smash you down and rip your jugular out right in front of your family, and they'll do it. They'll smear blood all over their faces right in front of your family and laugh at you. In your two-point stance. Now, if you're – there's obviously a time to run out of two-point stance, but there's other times where you're more versatile and you're a better offense if you got guys that can get down in three-point stance.
Do you have any fun Brad Meester facts if he was such a good dude?
I would say, let's see, two things. One is I want to say he went to Northern Iowa, which is a smaller school, which, again, I would say for offensive linemen, defensive linemen, this year especially where guys are – A lot of them haven't played in 2020 at all.
Yeah.
I like taking guys from smaller schools with third round picks because there's a chance that they've got some upside there Dylan Radunes from North Dakota State. Except the North Dakota State almost is that kid from University of Wisconsin Whitewater, Quinn Menierez. And I don't think he played last year. Guys like that, maybe there's a lot of upside there.
Yeah.
That people didn't know. The other thing about Brad Meester was that above his fireplace when he was a rookie, he had his wedding picture of him and his wife standing in her wedding dress.
Yeah.
And him in his tuxedo and him holding a football. It was we made fun of him a lot.
He had his wife in one arm and a football in the other arm?
Yes, he was holding it on and then he was holding the football kind of like he was Walter Payton or something in his
He's
left
an
arm.
Offensive yeah. lineman. He shouldn't even be holding the football to begin with in any picture.
A center, Sean. He's
yeah.
a center.
Oh, okay.
Very good. He touches the ball more frequently than the quarterback, to be truthful.
Well, then
sometimes it's a direct snap to a running back.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Well, then he should have been down snapping the ball to her. That's what the pose should have been. She should have been hands under center.
I bet they had a whole series, like one with her in eye black and everything.
That would be
beautiful. You know what? Wait a second. I'm going to alter that memory in my brain right now. In my memory, they both had eye black.
Okay. Good enough. Defensive line and edge rushers, according to, and again, Seth and I are digging into the Aaron Reese did a piece where he's projecting the most likely positions where you can find some good players where the Texans are picking in the draft. Wide receiver is number one. Offensive line is right there at 1A and maybe number one in terms of just finding a safe, high floor, solid starter. Defensive line and edge rusher, doable as well, but it looks like a much more high risk, high reward position.
Well, in this year with the – I mean, it's a – It's a deep year for pass rushing talent, except that it's all – there's a lot of raw and unknown. And that's when it gets scary because there's no better – there's no other position – there's no position quite like edge rusher where you look at guys who are absolute freaks and you think, my God, how could they not succeed in the NFL? Look at this guy. He's 6'5", 265 pounds. He runs a 4.4 40, and then nothing.
Yeah.
The guy we had from the Browns that was down here. And then Sean, the first round pick from the Browns that was with the Texans.
Barkevious Mingo?
Yeah, Barkevious Mingo. Yeah. It, like a physical freak, you know, it just has never really done anything in the NFL. There's all kinds of guys like that. They abound. And I would imagine that a few of those guys might drop down into the third round. I get really nervous about those guys just because you just can't tell. You just don't know. Even if they have good pass rush technique, you don't know how they're going to stand up to, again, you know, I was telling you about how offensive linemen in college have never really gone against full grown men. Likewise for defensive edge rushers. They've never gone against week after week these physical freak show offensive tackles. I guess the Texans' best example of this might be Trevardo Williams.
Yes.
Who was a fourth-round pick, so he was a little bit later than this. But Trevardo Williams was kind of a really raw physical specimen. But you'd look at him and you'd say, wow, this guy's a prototype. Yeah, I bet there's really something here. And I'm not sure if Trevardo Williams ever played a snap in the NFL.
I don't know that I don't know that he did. He went to UConn, and so I got the scouting report from my dad when they drafted him. Needless to say, my dad was all in on Trevardo Williams. He was like, "Oh, he's like Dwight Freeney," and I'm like, and as it turned out, he was not like Dwight Freeney.
Well, he was. I mean, he was 6'1", so that was a little bit accurate, right?
Yeah.
He played, you know what, Trevardo Williams, actually, because remember after he got out of, what, DeAndre Hopkins in 2014, there were a bunch of guys that never played a snap in the NFL, like Sam Montgomery and a few of those
Brennan Williams was on Monday Night Raw last night, by God.
That's right, yeah.
He was in the main event on Monday Night Raw last night. He was a draft pick of the Texans in 2013.
Not still in the NFL.
No. He's not moonlighting with WWE, no.
Trevardo Williams played a grand total of 3 games in the NFL, but did have 1 sack. So, you know, that 1 sack in 3 games, that puts him on pace for, you know, 5 sacks a season.
That's true. If he had ever played.
If it pans out for him, that's not bad.
To play 16 games. Oh, all right. So there you go. So the 3 positions easiest to find, or that the Texans have the best chance of finding somebody, according to the numbers of a big swath of time, 2000 through 2017, wide receiver, offensive line, defensive line / edge rusher. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Tuesday. Did you see Alex Bregman's new hairdo? Are these pictures real?
I see he's got braids, which I'm guessing he's had to spend some time in quarantine lately.
So you think he's just bored? So he's like, you know, I need to do something with his hair.
Yeah, I think he was bored and he had time. You know, it takes a while to get your hair put into braids like that. It didn't seem like his would be long enough to have kind of, you know, nice thick braids like that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, Bregman with braids. It's an interesting look. He looks like James Franco in Spring Breakers a little bit.
I never saw Spring Breakers.
It's a John McClane hit. John was the judge in that movie. And James Franco has braids like Alex Bregman has right now.
Is it one of the more critically acclaimed John McClane vehicles?
It is. It's kind of a weird movie. You know, it's very dark at times. It's a bit strange and kind of it's very anxiety-inducing. It's a lot like, from that standpoint, it reminds me of Uncut Gems, the Adam Sandler movie. Did you ever see Uncut Gems? Came out in the last couple years.
Yeah, I saw half of it. Yeah. And I said never again.
Spring Breakers is a lot like that. Very stressful.
Uncut Gems, I feel like, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and cross Try Cocaine off my bucket list.
Yes.
Because that must – I feel like when you see somebody that has done a bunch of coke or something, it looks like that's how I felt during that movie.
Yes.
It feels like just like everything's frantic, and I was paranoid the whole time, and I was afraid that I was going to wake up naked somewhere watching that movie. I cannot not recommend that movie enough. It is one of the most stressful, non-physically threatening things I've ever done in my life was watch that movie.
The big complaint about Adam Sandler seems to be, and I think probably a lot of it's out of jealousy, is like He doesn't make movies that have any meaning to them. It's the same script, but he Mad Libs in different characters, and he ends up making $20 million doing it because everybody goes and sees it because it's mindless tripe, and people love mindless tripe. And Adam Sandler, you're a pimple on the butt of the movie business. And so then he decides to make a serious movie, you know, that's not a comedy, this Uncut Gems. And by the end of it, I'm like, oh my God, please go back to doing Grown Ups or, you know, Happy Gilmore or whatever. Please go back to making, you know, Grown Ups 4, you know, like the Grown Ups franchise, you know, like it was, I'm like, I'm sorry I ever said anything about you making mindless movies, Adam Sandler. Please go back to that. Yeah, Uncut Gems, I needed to take a week off after that movie.
Well, that's what he's done. I think he's done it. Punch Drunk Love wasn't like that movie, but it was a more serious movie, and it was really, really weird.
Yeah.
Like, he goes kind of avant-garde when he goes off comedy.
Yeah.
So, maybe he just needs to try to hit one down the fairway with one of these things at some point, just do, like, a classic romance or something.
So, do we know for sure that this Bounty Gate, I'm going to call it the Bounty Gate movie. I know it's not about Bounty Gate, but I think that's what people know it by. It's the Sean Payton movie that's coming out that Adam Sandler's doing, where Kevin James is cast as Sean Payton. Do we know where on the comedic spectrum for Adam Sandler movies that movie's going to fall yet, Seth? Do we know?
I'm guessing it's going to be kind of like the Longest Yard remake.
Okay.
Because it's, it's not about Bounty Gate. It's about him coach. It's about Sean Payton coaching his kids' football team.
Right.
So I'm guessing just like, and actually that's a lot like the Longest Yard, right? God, I'm doing the Casario thing. It's contagious. I'm saying right a lot. It's caught on completely. It's taken the nation by storm. Right. So in the Longest Yard, the lead character, Adam Sandler, Burt Reynolds, whatever the hell his name was, whatever the character's name was, mm-hmm. he was in jail because of a gambling scandal of some sort. He was shaving points.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they don't really mention that other than that a few people are angry at him or they call him a couple of names based on it. But it's not really a central part of the movie. I'm guessing they treat Bounty Gate exactly like that in this movie. They'll make a few references to why Sean Payton is coaching his kids' team, but kind of, or you know, to take a more serious route, the Gene Hackman Hoosiers. Remember Hoosiers?
Norman
Gene
Dale.
Hackman was coaching high school because he'd gotten in some kind of a row back in Ithaca, New York, punched a kid or something.
Yeah.
But they don't really talk about it a whole lot.
No. They make him a lovable character in that movie.
I wonder if Greg Williams makes a cameo in this movie.
Ooh, who should play Greg Williams?
Oh, the most loathsome person available. Nah. I got it. Who would that be? I don't know. James Spader. Or something. Oh, no. It should be
David Schwimmer.
Spacey. No, make Kevin Spacey.
David Schwimmer. That's who should play it because I hate David Schwimmer. I'm just going to say it right now. I don't hate a lot of people. David Schwimmer. And I don't
but he's not loathsome.
You know who would have played Greg Williams back in the day if he were still alive? Sam Kinison would have been perfect to play Greg Williams.
Oh,
the comedian, the screamer. If Kevin James is going to play Sean Payton, then Kinison can play Greg Williams.
I don't see Kinison having a whole lot of range, though, other than just screaming a lot.
I don't see Greg Williams having a whole lot of range either. He's just a yeller.
Kevin James, you mean?
No, Greg Williams. That's a Kinison would have been perfect to play Greg Williams.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah.
No, Kevin Spacey is the guy.
Okay.
Kevin Spacey is the guy, once respected, now despised.
Yeah.
Kind of a creepy vibe to him anyway. You put on a pair of those shooting glasses that Greg Williams likes to wear and then some really bad beard coloring, and you've got Greg Williams.
It's a good
Williams,
pick.
Bam.
Yeah, it's a good pick. It's a good pick. Odyssey app. Download it today. Bring us with you wherever you go. If you've been listening, you know news is breaking all the time, especially with Deshaun Watson and all that going on right now. Bring the Odyssey app with you wherever you go. AUDACY. It's the former radio.com app. It's a really good app. Bring it with you. You can rewind. I used it yesterday. I used the rewind feature yesterday during In the Loop. All right. Up next, what does yesterday's filing mean for the Deshaun Watson trade market over the next 9 days? We will try to project next.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.